views expressed on this program are those of the hosts, guests, and callers, and are not necessarily those of this station, its management, or other advertisers. You're listening to Transformation Talk Radio.
Innovation, disruption, and big issues. This is Business Game Changers with Sarah Westall.
Welcome to Business Game Changers. I'm Sarah Westall, and today we are going to be doing something awesome. We are going to be talking about the brain and how one group of people are working on a solution for being able to upload the brain to another substrate and where that's at. I have one of the world's leading scientists in this area joining our program. His name is Randall Kuna, and he's going to explain where they're at, what they're doing, and whether it's possible. Well, obviously, he thinks it's possible. And in fact, he thinks this stuff is possible within the next couple decades. There'll be things this decade, next decade, and maybe three decades away. But he thinks most of the stuff is within the next couple decades that we will have the ability to upload a person's brain to another substrate and it being a replica of the brain. So very, very interesting stuff. So I don't want to waste much more time, and I want to get right into the interview with Randall Kuna.
Hi, Randall. Welcome to the program.
Hi, it's great to be here. Thanks.
Well, I have been told that you're the top scientist in the world, so that's a great kudos to you by other top scientists in the world that you are the one I should be talking to when it comes to brain interfaces with computer and also with our working on completely backing up our brain and transferring our entire brain to a computer or to another substrate, if you will. So I'm very excited to talk to you because we need to learn about this stuff. So first of all, you work for Kernel, which is a neural interface company. You're what, their chief scientist? And then you also have an organization you're working on that's called carboncopies.org. Can you explain what carboncopies.org is?
Sure. But first, I just want to say, I mean, that's great that people are saying such wonderful things about me, although I would never describe myself as the top scientist in, say, machine brain interfaces or anything like that. If anything, I'm just the person who has been persistently and doggedly going after advancing the cause of, say, whole brain emulation or mind uploading as a totality, as a whole, rather than, say, individual pieces of the neuroscience puzzle. And that's, I guess, my specialty is putting those things together.
Well, do you know who Dr. Bill Andrews is? He's the one that's working on lengthening telomeres, which he actually has a solution for that. And a trial is starting the end of this year. He's the one of the ones that told me I need to talk to you. So you should give him a little thank you for that.
I will do so. Yes. Thank you. That's great praise from him. So you wanted me to talk a little bit about carbon copies and what that is,
yes,
right?
Yes. What is that?
Yeah. So carbon copies is a group that we formed back in 2010 around this concept of whole brain emulation. So around the concept of how can you make something that would reproduce all of the functions of what's going on in your brain. So not necessarily every biological detail, but all of the functions that actually create the experience that you're having while you're conscious and while you're experiencing and while you're in your body, to reproduce all of that in another substrate that can carry out those functions. And that's kind of an abstract word for something like, well, it could be a computer, it could be a chip, it could be some kind of neuromorphic hardware that hasn't been developed yet or is in development at the moment, as long as it can represent those functions. And this organization exists to tie together the many different disciplines that are necessary to work on that problem, to contact and communicate with the various scientists, to also communicate with the general public about the idea, and to bring those people together and make projects possible. So to pursue the creation of either academic programs or commercial opportunities in that area. So, for example, the company I work at now, that is one of those commercial types of opportunities that carbon copies would love to see happen a lot more of. So we'd like to see that be something that people understand why this is important. And so part of what carbon copies is about is actually not even the technology itself, but just trying to explain why this matters. Why is it important to understand the brain to the point where you can create replacement parts for it, where you can build brains and your own mind in other machines? And that this is something I've been attempting to explain more and more when I speak publicly, to get away from the perception that mind uploading, that as a science fiction concept is just about, say, extending life. Extending how many years you can live is one interesting dimension to look at, but really the crux of what mind uploading is about having access to the fundamentals of how we think and what we can think about and what we can experience about the universe. So just like being able to work with the DNA, human DNA, is an ability to choose our destiny in a sense, to be able to say, we want to be able to adapt to deal with these kinds of illnesses that are coming along, or we want to be able to adapt to living a certain amount of time, or to be able to experience life in a certain environment. The same way, having that kind of access to what's going on in the brain and being able to update and improve and evolve, self-evolve towards a goal that we choose, that's really an essential part for if you look at the long-term future of humanity, because we are evolved into this niche right now. That was something, you know, we evolved into millions of years ago. So the sorts of things that we can observe about the environment, the types of things we can think about, the size of the groups of people we can associate with, the amount of information we can process, all of that is related directly to what we needed to survive in that time. But it's not necessarily as closely related to the things that are coming up. So, for example, the amount of information we're generating right now, when you look at everything that's popping up on the internet at the same time, or you look at the kinds of things we can observe in the universe right now, or even the types of calculations that our machines can carry out, much of that is way beyond what we can do or what our minds can fathom. And so, to me, the important thing about getting to the brain at that level of detail, but not just in depth, so in that detail, but also as a whole system and being able to understand it as what we are, that's really essential for us as a human species to be able to choose to go in all the different possible directions that we can go, whether we want to travel to another star and be perfectly adapted to that ecosystem there, or if we want to be able to live for a long time and carry out complicated projects here on Earth, or if we want to be able to associate with people in a manner that we couldn't before, perhaps to have greater understanding, greater empathy, to work as a collective in a way that you normally can't. Those are all very important things, I think.
Don't you think that there's just, like you were saying, there's so many limitations to what we can do in our current form, if you will. We don't live very long. It takes us... We need more time to do a complex project, right? I mean, we just can't, by the time we're kind of in our prime, we only have about 25 years in that point, you know, to be able to perform. Mm-hmm. So have you identified what specifically your goals are?
Yeah, but I just want to answer what you just mentioned briefly.
Okay, go ahead.
Because the amount of time you need to carry out a project, that depends on a lot of things. It depends, for example, on how fast you can think. So let's say if everything in your brain is working 10 times faster, then it seems like you can do 10 times more things, at least if they're intellectual things, things that you need your mind for in the same amount of time. So it's almost like extending time 10 times. That's one point. The other is that, of course, you know, extending the amount of time you have available is something important. I think it's one of the dimensions that is important to what you can do with improving our minds. And if you can do mind uploading, then you can do that too. You can, of course, you know, then store the mind and you can update the backup and you can build a new machine to run your brain on or whatever. So you can extend the time there. But also, you know, there are things such as, for instance, why is it that we need to take a quarter of our life to be able to just function, to learn all the things that other people have learned before us? What if many of those you could basically download much faster? How would that change?
Well, animals come out, like some animals come out knowing how to walk and run and do all these things, and we come out completely ignorant.
Right. Yeah. So these are all, you know, those are all different aspects of the same problem of having enough capability and time to be able to do the things that we want to do. And you can tackle them in so many different places in terms of the amount of time available, in terms of how long it takes to train, in terms of how fast you can think. So there are many different ways you can tackle the same problem. And the interesting thing about the technology of mind uploading is that in principle, you can use that to tackle it in all of those different ways. So not just one of them, but all of them. And then, yeah, you asked about something about if I've identified.
Yeah. Have you identified specifically what your organization's goals are now? I mean, because that I would assume that's kind of like the future thing. And those are all the different applications you can get. But what are you doing now and some of the goals that you've laid out now so that you can have stepping stones to getting there?
Yeah, the most important goal of the organization is to keep on iterating on a roadmap that explains the technological problems and explains some of the routes that you can take to solving them. So, for example, the main thing that that we lack at the moment is the ability to access all of the data in the brain. And by that, I mean you've got how are all the different parts of the brain connected to one another and how are they communicating? So that's the so-called connectome. The structure of the brain. There's a lot of work going into various imaging technologies right now to get that at ever greater resolution and scale, but we're still not quite there. And many of those technologies can't be used on a living person, so it's not an in vivo process. And then secondly, there's the functional part, the fact that the brain dynamics, we can look at it with an EEG or an MRI, both of which are very low resolution and not that useful for understanding what the neural circuitry is doing. So the main driver there is really building ever better interfaces that can actually resolve the information of neurons firing in terms of the electrical activity going on at each individual neuron. This is the sort of work that Kernel and other companies that are working on neural interfacing are getting involved with, because we need to get away from being able to look at very rough pictures like on an MRI, or being able to record from a few individual neurons. But instead, we want to be able to look at thousands or millions of neurons operating together and see how they're cooperating, because that's how you then take the structure of the brain. You overlay this information about the function and you can derive circuit function. It's basically a reverse engineering of the brain as if it were, say, some machine with a bunch of intricate circuits inside of it that you have to learn about what they're doing. And that's number one, is just getting access to that data. And it's very important for us to understand what the problem is of getting to that data and what the different methods are that you can use to approach it. This is the sort of thing that goes into the roadmap. And then the second part of that is that you need to understand how to work with the data, because just taking the data and having it stored somewhere on a drive is not the same thing as having a working prosthesis, a working emulation, some working part of your brain. So that's really going from the neural circuit understanding to how do you run it. And then if you want to run it, you need hardware you can run it on. That's another part of that puzzle. And so you have all these different pieces that, you know, there's some work that has been done already. There are some ways we can use now. There is a level that we need to get to for each of those. And then there are ways to get to that level of capability. And it's those things that end up in that roadmap. So building this roadmap is one of the main things that the organization is about. And then reaching out to people who can benefit from that roadmap, who want to participate, or who can contribute to it.
Because they can help fund it and help it go quicker. So where are you in some of these elements? As a species, where are we? I mean, how far along are we in figuring on getting some of those pieces of the roadmap done and usable?
I would say that on the side of getting structured data, we're doing relatively well. A main problem is that most of the methods we have there are not in vivo methods, so that either you have to infer things from the general structure of what brains are like, even though everyone's structure is slightly different. Or you have to come up with ways that could be used in vivo. And those are still very much in their infancy. There are some techniques, such as building microscopes that can be embedded in live brains and record while the brain is operating. This exists and is done with animals at the moment. But it's definitely not something that's ready for prime time. So on the structure side, the kinds of maps we can make are getting pretty good. But there is this issue of how do you get the map of a specific person, especially if that person is still alive. Now, of course, you could say, what if you can just record all the dynamic data first, and then you wait until a person is deceased and then collect all the structure data? There's that possibility that you could make it a post-mortem process.
Have we done that? Have we tried that yet?
To some degree. There are definitely, I mean, in animals, yes, certainly. So this post-mortem collection of brain data, brain structure data, that's basically what all of connectomics and neuroscience is about right now. It's using some sort of microscope, either it's a NIFED scanning microscope or it's some kind of electron microscope, on slices of brain tissue from a mouse or from some other animal, and then putting all that data back together again into a 3D map. And this has also been proposed to be done with human brains, although right now none of those technologies can work fast enough to work through a human brain any faster than, say, it would take 100 years mm-hmm. to collect all the data. So it's mostly a parallelization process that needs to be improved. But it's one of these things that ties into how some people think, for example, about cryonics. There are really two groups in cryonics. There's the group that...
Can you explain what cryonics is?
Oh, sorry, yes. That's okay. Cryonics is another approach to attempting to live longer, which is that you after death, you infuse the body to ensure that ice crystals don't form in the blood and in the brain and in all the organs, and then cool it down to a very low temperature so that there are very few changes over time. And that way you could preserve a person or a person's brain for a long period, say hundreds of years if necessary. And then when you have the technology to revive a person, to bring them back, then you would take this largely preserved person and you would either try to bring them back to life. That's what the one group wants, is to basically still be in their body and be revived in that body, have all of their functions restored. And the other side of it is a group of people who would be happy to have mind uploading carried out, which means that you then take this preserved body and you use that to scan for structure information in the brain and use that to create a mind upload.
Okay. This is incredible. You know what's incredible is how much it compares to computer science and systems thinking.
It really does, yeah.
It's all systems thinking, and it's an engineering project or program, or I'm sorry, it's an engineering problem. You know, you look at it systematically, computer science and brain technology. It's very interesting. So keep going on what, before I had answered the question about what is cryonics, you were on a topic and then I stopped you quick to ask what cryonics is. And then you were,
oh, right. Yeah. I was talking, you had asked me where we are today. Yes. With these technologies. And so I decided to talk first about the structure part, because that's the part that has received, I would say, the most attention, to the point where you're talking both about high resolution and about large systems so that you can get information at scale. That is something where in terms of function dynamics, being able to extract that information, we're just not as far yet because the technology hasn't been there until recently.
Do you think we need to get to a biological computing environment, a chemical computing, not electric, not zeros and ones, but a different paradigm?
Are you talking about the implementation on what you would run an emulation on, or how you would extract the information about what's going on in the system?
You're saying, well, either or, it's not fast enough, right? So do we need another paradigm, another leap?
Well, it's not that it's not fast enough. The fast enough part is just about getting the structure information, because it just takes a long time to use electron microscopes to scan a lot of samples. So that's really a technology problem of how do you build systems that can scan a lot of surface area at the same time. The function dynamics are not that hard to record in terms of speed. Neurons are relatively slow.
But do we need to have a different way of scanning? I mean, we could almost get to a point where we could directly communicate with the brain if we knew how it communicated, right?
Well, you need an access port, basically. You need a way to get to the brain. The brain is not built to send information out directly. The only output we have is really through speech. And we have some various input ports, the eyes and the ears and that sort of thing, but we don't have a lot that goes straight to the brain. EEG is an attempt to go directly to collecting brain data, and something like TDCS or TMS, those are approaches to try to use electromagnetism or electrical current to put information into the brain. But they're extremely rough. The resolution is terrible. So
how does the brain send data down your spine and things? So we would have to start to understand how the data from your brain is actually moving through the body and then figure out how to extract it the same way.
Yeah, so the brain certainly sends information through nerve fibers into the rest of the body and also collects information from the body. Collecting information from fibers in your spine also requires neural interfacing. And right now, again, those are not high-resolution interfaces. So those are the ones that we're currently trying to build, and companies like Kernel are trying to do that because we can now use chip technology to make much better interfaces than were available in the past few decades. But even once you have that, you really want to get directly into the brain. You want to get data straight from there because everything that's being sent through the spine, it's really just the data that the brain wants to send to the body. So all the thoughts that were behind what actions your body is supposed to carry out, none of that is being sent directly. You don't have access to any of the thoughts. And the same way, if you're sending information back into the brain, it's really just this basic information about how you feel, about what's coming from your body, sensory information that the brain is then trying to interpret. But all those interpretations, again, you're not having direct access to those interpretations.
Do you think there is a way to do it that we haven't figured out yet? Or do you think scanning and taking the pictures is going to be the ultimate way to do it?
No. I didn't mean to say that scanning was going to be the way to do it. I really believe that it's a combination of structure and function, because just scanning the brain doesn't tell you how the parts work. A lot of things that look the same can actually operate differently. Mm-hmm. So it's important that we have this very good understanding of the library of all the structures in the brain, which means we need to record from them. Now, that functional recording is essential. And I think that we do have avenues towards much better recording methods. One is that our neural interfaces, the old-fashioned kind where you go in and you put electrodes in, are indeed getting a lot better, so that we can be talking about recording from thousands of neurons in the next few years at the same time. So concurrently thousands. And then in just a few more years after that, we'll be talking about millions just using that technology. And that's not that bad, because the brain is a distributed system. So even if you can sample only from 1% of all the neurons there, it's entirely possible that 1% could be enough to reconstruct what's going on in the circuit.
How distributed is the brain? And I don't want you to continue in your thought, because I don't want to mess up your thought, but it's a distributed system. So, and usually, you know, you see something that might have a couple different processes. Does a brain have 100 different, 1,000 different things going on at the same time? And then also, do we have brain elements in our stomach and things, other places?
Yeah. We don't have to go on the technology topic right now, except to say that in addition to the electrical recording and stimulation method that are getting better, there are additional ones around the corner, like optogenetics and other methods that are attempting to get around the hurdle of using interfaces with electrical wires going into the brain. So there is something else around the corner there. But to address your question, which is actually much more interesting, is the brain is operating on a lot of different things at the same time. So this whole notion that maybe we're only using 10% or 2% or whatever the brain, that's nonsense. Of course, we're using all of the brain, otherwise it wouldn't be there. Except it's not all on at the same time, because if it were, that would be the same thing as having an epileptic seizure. But all the different parts are being used, and the brain is certainly doing 100 or 1,000 different things at the same time, because all of this is a system where there is a hierarchy of structure where basic data is being processed at the bottom and combined into more complex data, so that you can understand from what you're seeing, what is a car, what is a person, what does this all mean, what do I remember about that, what are my emotions associated with that, then storing memories about it, and so forth. So it's this complicated chain, this big tree that just grows through the tree, through the brain, of information being processed and pushed forward to other places. And it involves long-term processes like storing information in synaptic changes, but also short-term processes such as activity that's being maintained while you have these different brain rhythms going on, like a theta and gamma rhythm, where you have over a short period of time, like a fifth of a second, every fifth of a second, a certain memory is being reactivated and maintained so that you can use it in your working memory and carry out tasks. So you have all this sort of distributed information going on. And at the same time, it's not encoded in the same way in every place in your brain. So the neocortex, for example, will have a very distributed way of encoding what you've seen. There may be pieces of an image that you have seen that are encoded in very different parts of the brain, so that if you were to damage one piece of that brain, it would only degrade the perception of that image or the memory of that image to a small degree, but you would still basically have that memory. It's a very good property of distributed systems. But other parts of this of the brain don't work with that code. Other parts have neurons that take on very important roles, where a single neuron is the target of a lot of incoming fibers and the output for a lot of different areas. So it's kind of like a small world property, as they say in network sciences. And that an area that has that is, for example, in the hippocampus, where you have a very small part of the brain that's receiving a lot of information from everywhere else in the brain and putting it together, forming concepts, new things that you can store away in memory and store them for a while until you have the chance to then create a distributed representation of that in your neocortex. That's why the hippocampus is essential for retrieving new memories for about 3 weeks. And then after those 3 weeks, you can retrieve those memories even if your hippocampus were destroyed, because by then it's been stored in a distributed way. And you have a new concept in
your mind. So it takes 3 weeks to stew the backup of the memory. It's in it's in your immediate, and then it's in your backup. And but now when it's in your backup, you know, because when it's in your immediate, it's all fresh and you understand it. It goes into your backup and you just don't, it's a different level of being able to access it, right? I mean, because
it's definitely different. Yeah. So when you're accessing memory that is hippocampus dependent, it's very much, okay, what happened at this time on that day? And you recall one piece and then it retrieves all the sequence of other things that were associated with that. You know, I spoke to this person, then that happened, then that happened, then that happened, and then I drove away. Whereas if you have something in your long-term memory and it's distributed like that, not only does it attempt to store what that memory was and the sequence of what was going on, but it also integrates it with the rest of your memory. So you have these reactivations of memory in your brain while you're sleeping, for example. That there are two different important phases there. There's slow wave sleep, where you're not dreaming, and there's REM sleep, where you are dreaming. And it's thought that these two have very different roles. So, for example, you can see the reactivation of the same neurons that were active when you were experiencing an event in the hippocampus during that slow wave sleep, and they reactivate in the same order. So that's basically when that memory is being strengthened, when it's being consolidated and stored away in distributed memory. And in REM sleep, you see reactivation of some known patterns and some other patterns that don't belong there that are from other memories, perhaps. So it could be that at that point, your memory, your brain is creating new associations between older knowledge, things you already knew, and new knowledge, so that there are other ways to retrieve what you knew. It's kind of like how if you become an expert at something, then you can just make these associations between things. You just know, oh, wait, that means that. This is all connected. Oh, now this reminds me of something else.
So is that why when you're sleeping, you can come up with, you wake up and you just figure things out? Sometimes sleeping is where you come up with your biggest breakthroughs.
Yeah, I mean, I can only speculate because we don't really know the details of this. But one thing is very, very clear. Sleep is intricately involved with memory processes and is very important for memory storage and definitely, like, for example, you know, if you have kids and they're studying for an exam and they really want to do well and you want them to be able to remember what they studied later instead of just for that exam, tell them they have to start studying this at least 6 days in advance, because that's how many sleep cycles you need to get that properly into your memory.
Oh, wow. Interesting. So sleep, and I've heard this before, sleep is an integral part of the whole memory. And I've had people tell me they think you need the sleep just so your brain can sit and process the data and the memories and kind of do its thing. are you kind of getting to that point where that maybe that's what sleep is about, is to yeah, deal with our memories?
At least in animal studies, this has been mostly done with mice and rats, with primates. And actually, no, sorry, there are also sleep studies in humans that have now been able to trace activity in the brain while sleeping, because they've been doing studies with epilepsy patients who had to have recordings done anyway to locate the source of their epilepsy. And they were volunteers to have recordings done even while they're asleep. And so you find out information about what activity is going on during sleep. So now we have a pretty good of evidence, at least, that's saying this is true. In sleep, that's when your brain is working hard on memory, when memories are being consolidated or when memories are being associated with other memories.
So how come when we go under hypnosis, you know, when people are regressed, they can see things in detail? I mean, they remember everything, whereas when we're awake, we can't.
Yeah, hypnosis is a strange topic in my mind. I mean, when you look at an fMRI of someone who's under hypnosis, it's very interesting to see that most of the areas that you would see when you're just awake in a conscious state are active too, but there are some small differences. And I'm not entirely sure what's going on, but from what we do know, just, and then most of this is not about neuroscience, but more cognitive science. One thing is clear: people are very suggestible under hypnosis, right? And we also know that in general, we don't actually have memory the way that computers have memory. We don't really retrieve photographs. We retrieve constructs. Like, you know, I'll wake up and somebody asked me what happened yesterday, and I'll say, oh, I think I woke up and I got out of bed because that seems really reasonable. That's what I always do. And I think that's what beds look like. So that's my memory of that. And what you're saying, it seems very much more detailed, very high resolution that people are retrieving in hypnosis. My first question as a scientist would be, well, are you sure that that's actually what's going on? Because can you tell? We haven't really recorded what their memories are. So you can't say this is that detailed. This is just their report of what's going on. So either it feels much more high resolution. That's one possibility, because of the state that you're in, that it feels like you can explore your memory more and you get into detail and you spend time thinking about it and you make these constructs in greater detail than you normally would. Or it could be that they're really retrieving information in greater detail, that they're somehow accessing their memory in better detail and retrieving more parts of what has been stored away in long-term memory. That's possible. So it could either be real, that there actually is a better access to the memory while under hypnotic state, or it could be that it is a perception, a sensation of having more detailed memory. But it's hard to tell if it's correct, right? Because, you know, I mean, you're...
Well, yeah, unless you really know. Memory. Part of it could be you've created a focus. You cleared your mind for one purpose. And so
it would be interesting to see if there were experiments where you could do this. Like, say, have someone read a book that they've never read before and just read it once, not do anything special, no, like, memory tricks, no going over every line 10 times or something, but just read it through and then see if when they, under normal circumstances versus under hypnosis, do they get more correct? Do they get more of the precise, say, the text? Can they recall anything verbatim, or can they recall more aspects of the story more clearly? So there must be ways to test that in a very sort of concrete, objective way.
Yeah, I would imagine some of that has been done. I'm not sure.
Yeah, I'm not an expert in that area, so I don't
there's
know.
So much new stuff going on. Okay, well, let's dive into what you are an expert, which is huge amounts of stuff. So who is helping you work on this problem now? Where are you at with, you know, the people that you have?
Yeah, so I should talk about that in two different ways. One is carbon copies and the other is as Kernel. And as I said before, unfortunately, I can't say too much about Kernel because it really is still an operation in stealth mode, as most startups are.
It's cool. So can you give people a description of what those two organizations do and what you do for them? And then people will understand more why you can't talk in too much detail.
Yeah. I'll just say briefly about Kernel that I worked with Brian Johnson for a number of years before Kernel got started. So I've gotten to know him very well, and he's very dedicated to the topic, and he really understands how difficult all of this is. And so he's trying very hard to build an organization that has enough resources. So he's dedicated $100 million of his own dollars to this to get it going. But he understands that those resources won't last for very long with all the things that need to be developed. So he's also building an organization that should be able to stand on its own feet, that will produce revenue, while at the same time keeping its eyes on the long-term goal. So I just wanted to say that to start with, that this is something I've learned by working with Brian for many years now, and he's really great. In the organization, I mostly deal with computation and system strategy problems. So kind of the same sort of thing that I've dealt with in carbon copies and in my previous career. And I try to occupy myself with that because I really like to figure out what we need to do to understand the data we're collecting from the brain to be able to build replacement parts. And also, how do we make sure that this goes from what we can do today, where we're trying to at first build something that can help at least patients who are suffering from brain diseases or damage, and then move from there to our long-term goals. How can we make sure that this stretch from the short-term to long-term happens in a way where we keep addressing capabilities we need to build out and don't get distracted by things that that shouldn't be our main focus, but at the same time also over the course of time do things that help as many people as possible so that it's really beneficial. So that this is kind of what I occupy myself with at Kernel. There are many other very smart people there. I'm not going to go into detail about that because we haven't made them all public on the website. And so I don't want to, you know, do anything like that.
So what are some of the bigger goals so that people can understand what you're working towards?
The bigger goal really is to create an ability to read and write processes of the brain, to build neural interfaces that allow us to help people who have cognitive problems, but also enable us to enhance our cognition. So it's, you have to start somewhere where, the problems are interesting enough that they help us forward, but also simple enough that we can tackle them and don't fail early. You know, we want to be able to move on towards the bigger problems. So we're trying to line these up in a logical fashion. And I really can't tell you about strategy because that would just be,
absolutely.
This is a no-no. We're not going to do that.
Are you also working with the government or is it all private institution?
The institution itself is entirely private. It's privately owned, privately funded.
Are some of your clients government? Are they shown interest or no?
We're not saying no to anyone at the moment. So whether it's private or public, who we collaborate with, partner with, or who are clients, that's entirely open at the moment.
So what does carbon copies do?
So in carbon copies, like I said, I mean, one of the main things we do is build this roadmap. And the people involved there are, part of it is a small circle of people who understood a long time ago why mind uploading, why neural technology and whole brain emulation, why that is a very important topic for humanity going forward. So there are people who have been working with me on this since the mid-1990s. Some names there are Ken Hayworth, who's very well known for his work in connectomics, he runs the Brain Preservation Foundation. There's also, there's Keith Wiley, who recently wrote a book about mind uploading to try to explain some of the terminology and some of the ideas in more detail. And he's been helping out a lot on that side on trying to explain basic things about what mind uploading is. And others who, like Mallory Tackett, has recently taken over trying to build out the structure of the Carbon Copies organization more. So she's put a lot of time into the 501c3 application and other essential things in the organization. She's great. So we have this small core of people who, and I'm sorry if I didn't mention some other important people, and I know there are others, and I just want to make sure I, didn't offend anyone by not mentioning them by name. But there is this core group of people who put in a lot of dedicated time as volunteers, just to get everything up on its feet. And that's because we're transitioning from an earlier phase before companies like Kernel came along, where we were just trying to explain and just trying to gauge interest and get people interested and make things happen, make these sorts of projects and companies happen, to a process where now we want to work with these other organizations that have come up around the Brain Initiative and around Kernel and others, and to have them all have a place where they can interact, where there is certainly no commercial confusion of interests. There's no issue there, and where the hurdles that are ahead of us can be tackled in a very systematic way and bring in all the different disciplines that we want to have. So we're trying to rebuild Carbon Copies right now into an organization that takes this current state of affairs and that can work long-term with these organizations, with the other organizations that are out there, and also be a face to the general public. And this is a process that's still ongoing. So we're, you know, as I told you, we're still...
What's in the early stages? You guys are the pioneering scientists on this. So are you seeing interest in this organization? Are you seeing interest from the government? You know, some of the government, because I know the CIA, I just did a thing with Annie Jacobson, who is a Pulitzer Prize finalist for a lot of the books that she's done on the secret investigations they do and the research they do. But this would be right up their alley on some of the things that they would want and some of the things that they would be doing. And so I'm just curious if you've done any collaboration with them. And I suppose you, if it's top secret, you won't let me know, but I would think they would be very interested in this kind of work.
Yeah. So, I mean, government organizations like DARPA and IARPA, IARPA is the intelligence agency version of DARPA. They are interested, and they've been talking to myself and other people in the organization and at companies like Kernel over and over again. They also have their own projects that they finance, such as the NESD program recently, which is an explicitly a program that attempts to build new neural interfaces to be able to record from a million neurons at the same time. So they have these programs going on. They are interested, but it's not to the point where, say, a government organization would come and try to set up a project directly with Carbon Copies or directly with a company like Kernel and say, we want this from you and you deliver this to us. It's definitely not at that stage.
So it seems like the government is just kind of maybe holding back, watching what you're doing and seeing if there's some really great developments that they can utilize and then maybe fold it into some of their experiments and some of the things that they're doing.
Yeah, to a degree. I would say that they're not really holding back where the science is concerned. That's where the Brain Initiative and DARPA and all of their programs come in. But putting it all together and saying, okay, neural prosthesis is something that's really around the corner and we should be thinking about things like mind uploading, I don't think the government is quite there yet. So yeah, they're kind of holding off on that. Yeah.
Okay, and they're kind of waiting to see what you guys can do, kind of forge and pioneer it. And then once it gets to a point where they see that it can apply it as something useful for their programs, then I can see them really getting involved. I could see them being a big client of yours.
It's possible. For me, it's really hard to predict what government does. I don't really understand very well, you know, all the motivations in the background and their needs. But you're right. I could see a lot of applications. Sure. Yeah.
I would just hope that, you know, there's dark and there's light for technology. And most of the, I'd say almost 100% of the scientists I talk to and the engineers and the, you know, the people on the pioneering front of technology, they are always looking at the light, the good things that technology can do. But there's so many dark parts, and sometimes the government can wander into some of those. And I would hope that they are smart enough and wise enough once we get to the point of the brain technology that they're wise enough to stay in the light and not use it for dark purposes. Because it can really get powerful now. I mean, we're talking about some seriously powerful technology.
I think we also have to acknowledge, though, that there are, of course, a lot of different governments. Government isn't just a single body,
exactly,
a single place. Yeah.
And we don't have control over all the governments. And I had somebody on that, the the CRISPR-Cas9, and their lab was the one that actually identified the fact that CRISPR-Cas9 cuts in a lot of secondary locations, and they didn't realize that. And other countries, you can't control the things that labs are doing in other countries, and they're working with embryonic stem cells, and that could change the human genome forever. And, you know, that's powerful, but the stuff you're doing is just as powerful. I mean, it's at that magnitude of some of the things that we can do. But I want to, you know, now that we're talking about that, I want to talk about some of the things that we can do and hear what you have to say about that. But we kind of got into it a little bit about being able to learn without experiencing it. And we saw it in the Matrix movies where they would download, she needs to be able to fly the helicopter. So they downloaded the ability to fly the helicopter. Yeah. And he sat there all day trying to learn things and he just couldn't get enough. What is the possibility that we could actually be implanted with knowledge of a language or a technique on how to do something? Because I know at Stanford, they were just working with mice and they were able to program the maze for a mouse into their brain without the mouse ever seeing the maze before. And then they knew it.
Yeah, it wasn't quite like that. It wasn't that they programmed the maze into the mice. It was more that they had taught one mouse how to do the maze, and then that mouse's experience was helping the second mouse learn it faster.
Oh, okay.
Yeah.
How did they take the one mouse's knowledge and help the other mouse?
They were recording in one mouse's brain, and they were stimulating the other mouse's brain in the same area of the brain, the hippocampus in this case, with the same signals. So it was a matter of assuming that if you can just get the same electric signals from neurons in the brain over to the other brain, that even if perhaps the brain isn't perfectly the same, that somehow the signals would still be interpreted in a useful manner. And I think that's what that really came down to. That, you know, the task was simple enough and the interpretation of the signal simple enough that it helped to some degree. It's not the same thing as actually implanting specific memories. It's not like the helicopter flying or the, remembering Shakespeare or something like that. That's really tough because even though we know that of course all human brains tend to use the same brain areas for the same sort of tasks, that's not always true because if you were born missing a huge part of your brain, other parts of the brain can learn to take over or do those tasks instead, and you've got things like that. But in general, we do have region specificity. But then when you look inside those regions and you look at how the synapses are actually attached, which ones are strong, which ones are weak, what that means, you'll find that the very specific connectomes which lays out the memory in people is different from person to person. So just taking the memory of Kung Fu, let's say, in the Matrix and downloading it into another person doesn't mean anything if the muscles don't connect through the same nerve fibers in exactly the same way with the parts of your brain that control them in a certain manner. So you might give a signal that you think means move your arm up, but then instead your other arm goes sideways or something like that. So it's not a very simple task to download memory, but that doesn't mean it's impossible. It's like we can build translators, Google Translate or whatever. It may be possible to build translators where you take an understanding of your brain and how you represent concepts, knowledge, skills, activity. And by understanding how that's laid out in your brain, and you take the brain of a teacher and you look at how they understand and speak Spanish or something like that. And then you look into the student brain again and say, well, how would I best map this so that the student will quickly learn Spanish, so that they'll have a rudimentary ability to speak Spanish, and maybe perfecting it will be super easy for them. You can probably find a way to make a mapping like that. But it means that you have to understand an awful lot about the representations that are in the student's brain and the representations that are in the teacher's brain. It's a tough translation problem.
Well, how far do you foresee us being able to do this in a reasonable amount of time, like in a decade?
It depends on the kind of knowledge you're trying to download. So Kung Fu may be easier than language, for instance. It may turn out that in the external parts of the body where the connections directly go to muscle and sensation, that It's easier because there's less of a layered translation. There's less complexity involved in these concepts that you can learn how to decipher those faster. So that may help us, for example, within the next few years to build programs that can help people who need to recover from stroke or something else, who need to do, you know, a physical therapy, to help them recover from that much faster. And that's something I can see happening in the next 5-10 years. Whereas I think that understanding the core concepts in our brain sufficient degree that you could learn math or another language or something like that, that's probably further down the line. That's somewhere like 15, 20 years, 25 years, maybe from where we are now.
But that's still 25 years is still not very long if we could actually do that.
Yeah, that's my personal belief. Just looking at the problem space and looking at where we're headed and tying in our improved ability to use machine learning to understand large amounts of data and parse through them. My personal feeling is that none of these things are really very far away. It's we're talking about differences in how many decades. Is it this decade? Is it the next decade? Or is it the decade after that?
Wow, that's incredible. So could we do nefarious things that just wouldn't be good? Like they could blast out implants in people's brains that might tell them to do something that they're unconsciously might do. I mean, like, could we be doing things unconsciously and not be aware that we're getting messages to do something?
We could be doing that right now, right?
Yeah, I know. So I want to know, what is the possibility of that? I mean, there could be nefarious other governments doing things like that to us too. I mean, it's not always just our government that's a bad guy. It could, like you said, other governments, our government could be trying to stop that. But my point is that what is the likelihood that they could do that to us?
Well, I don't think that they'll get there any faster than the good guys will at doing the good stuff. I think it's the same technology, basically, right? The nefarious stuff requires the same tech as the good stuff, in a sense. And it comes at different degrees of potential of danger or goodness, if you like. So it's about the same timeline. But there's nothing that would make it, you know, I mean, who says that you're going to do something good or something bad with technology? You decide how you apply it. And then there are rules, and there is society and cultural agreements, etc. But, you know, I mean, you can use a car to get from A to B, or you can use a car to run into a crowd of people. It's the same thing with other technology. It's the same with brain implants. Just to quickly finish that, you want to build in a certain amount of security, just like we put in safety measures on the internet, and we say we really want all of our data to be encrypted when we're on there so that other people can't listen in or they can't pretend to be us or something like that. And in the same way, you can build in a certain amount of security in the implants that we are getting for good reason. Like, let's say we want an implant because it will help us recover from a stroke, and then we want to make sure that that implant has a cryptographic key on it that is very personal to us and that nobody else can get at it. So we hope that nobody can mess with this. But that doesn't mean that if you're captured by a foreign government or something, and then they take you off into some sort of hidden hospital room and they give you an evil implant that doesn't have any of those safeguards and that isn't really yours, but that is totally under their control. Well, what are you going to do? That's because you're physically in their hands and they can do to you whatever they want. And it's the same as it is now. If you're in someone else's hands and they can do whatever they want to you, it's very hard to put in safe measures.
Yeah, but how can they do even now? Could they do nefarious basic things? Like, could they send a message to us to not cooperate, you know, to be or have increased anxiety or stress or something that would...
Oh, yeah, sure. Absolutely.
You know what I mean?
They do that all the time. They do it all the time.
Well, how do they...
This is what political messaging and advertising and all of that is about. It's psychology. It's cognitive state that you're changing. You're making people more anxious about the situation in the world, or you're making them more comfortable with the situation in the world. You're trying to manipulate them to vote for you and not vote for the opponent, et cetera. This is going on all the time.
Yeah, so this is psychology. So we know that. Can they do it at an even increased level where they directly send signals to your brain, or... is it sufficient? Is the signals that are going to your brain just as strong as what we're getting with propaganda?
So, yeah, my take on it right now is that there is no technology available today where anybody could be beaming something into your mind that is in any way better, probably worse, it's probably just nothing, than any of what they could do through psychology or cognitive science, in a sense. I think the psychology approach is currently the strongest, best controlled, most dangerous weapon in that brain-mind area that we have. There is no, you know, ray gun that is shooting a ray into your mind and making you do something. And that simply does not exist today.
But they are pretty astute at sending propaganda and things to really scare people. Because I'm telling you, I've never seen an election year like this. And the anxiety and the stress level was so high. It was incredible.
Yeah, I completely agree with you. I think that that psychology has gotten good enough at understanding people, at least statistically on average, as in will the largest, you know, proportion of the population start to feel this way or that way. Yeah, that they're very good at doing that sort of manipulation.
Yeah, it was crazy. Okay, so let's move into a harder part of your brain. Maybe it's not harder, but I would think it would. When you're trying to understand emotions and personality, how do you map that and track that?
When you're trying to map emotions and personality, well, you know, at least to my knowledge, there isn't anything intrinsically different in the sense that, of course, emotions and personality are also taking place within your brain, in brain processes. So using synapses, using electrical signals between neurons, chemical signaling between neurons, all of the same things. That doesn't mean that they're mapped out, that they're programmed or used by the same parts of the brain. Sometimes it can be a much simpler thing. So for instance, many emotions may turn out to be a relatively simple on-off button or dial that kind of depends on a certain amount of chemical in a part of the brain that is then activating a specific type of neuron more or less, and that has a certain effect on how you feel. So there are some emotions that are simple like that. And I almost don't like that we call all of these things emotions, because it feels like some of them are so basic, are very much almost animal drives.
Yes.
And others are really complex, where it's an emotion that has something to do with how we experience the situation and what we've learned from it and what we feel about it. And it kind of goes, it's really complicated. And in those cases, I almost don't want to call it the same thing. I want to think about it more just like something we've learned or a process we're going through, a dynamic brain process, and then it involves everything. It involves the neocortex and the hippocampus and the amygdala and all the other parts of the brain that work together. So it can be just as complicated as any other part of knowledge that you want to understand or download or modify or preserve. Those bits get difficult, but some of the very basic emotional stuff is probably, those are the first and early targets for the kind of interfacing that would help people. So, for example, to be able to dial down anxiety if you want to, or to be able to get away from depression if you want to. Some of these things can have dials that are easier to get to, that where, say, you use a more global type of stimulation, similar to DBS, where you have a big electrode that is just pulsing away. You can have something that is maybe near the amygdala and that is dialing down your state of anxiety. So this is some of the stuff that I think you can see coming up in the next, within this decade, actually. Those simple things, I think, will have very new ways of directly dealing. And I think some of them, it's very good to have that ability, because if you take a drug to deal with it, let's say you're taking a drug against anxiety or depression, first of all, it takes a very long time sometimes for it to work, because many of these antidepressants, you need to take them for a week before they start working. And secondly, when you're on them, meaning it's in your system and in your system constantly. And wouldn't it be nice if you could just sometimes dial it down and then dial it back up again, like just turn on and off these things. Say you're going into a social situation and you would like to be a little bit less anxious. You just dial that down. Now, you're feeling good in your situation, in the social situation, because you dialed down your anxiety a little bit. When you come out of it, turn it back up to normal, and you didn't need to drink. You didn't need to take any alcohol to get into that state where your anxiety. And not drinking is probably a good thing. So there are a lot of interesting trade-offs that we can make between how we've been dealing with issues that we call emotional feeling or personality for a while versus the way we can start to deal with them when we have more direct ways of controlling what's going on in our own brain.
And we don't have enough time for the full thing. This is just part one. Part two will be playing on Wednesday. And you can also get, of course, you can get it on podcast at my website at sarahwestall.com or on YouTube or many other places. There's about 90 different streaming and podcast channels that you can reach my program at. So again, I want to remind you, sarahwestall.com, and you can get Randall's contact information and information on how to get involved in this really amazing project that they're working on. But for now, I hope everybody has an amazing day.
You've been listening to Business Game Changers with host Sarah Westall. Tune in each Monday at noon Pacific, 3 Eastern, as Sarah brings you leading experts, visionaries, and newsmakers who provide the best commentary on big issues and cutting-edge innovations. Sarah's 20 years as a business executive will help you think like an entrepreneur with expertise, energy, and attitude. Tune in Mondays at 12 noon Pacific time and learn more about Sarah at sarahwestall.com today.